to cultivate compassion for global social transformation. And part of what we're doing with ourselves as males, the new compassionate male, is to recognize that part of us, that hardwired part that has been so neglected over the centuries, over the millennia. You know, there's this stereotype that we're put in, and it's not fair. You know, it's not fair, because I think we, as hopefully developing compassionate males, recognize this, as Clay and I have talked many times, this feminine part of our being is this masculine part, and it's both in the female gender and the male gender. And
yes.
Once we recognize that and make those choices, then we can really move into realization of compassion.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and today we are in search of the new compassionate male. I'm the producer of this podcast. I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay.
Hey, Dennis, how you doing?
Would you introduce our repeat guest who we are going to be having on again and again and again?
Absolutely, absolutely. Charlie Barker. Charlie's a dear friend. He's board chair of the Charter for Compassion, and he's founder and president of Charter for Compassion Dallas-Fort Worth. He's got a background in medicine and something very interesting, biomedical ethics. What else? He's working on a book, and I consider him my dear friend and mentor.
How lovely. And I am a new friend. And so I get a chance to learn more about you, Charlie, and learn more about what you're doing. So can we start at biomedical ethics? Can you tell us a little bit about that? What an interesting word that is. And certainly in this time of information and disinformation, where it would be a subject that would be important in the September of 2020 for me to understand a little more about.
Absolutely. Well, first and foremost, thank you for this opportunity to have a conversation. As Clay mentioned, this is a conversation. It's not a one-sided thing, so I really appreciate that. Biomedical ethics is near and dear to my heart. In fact, I was in private practice for 15 years in Southern Georgia, and just felt a call at the end of those 15 years, which was near 1990, to study more ethics. I felt a law degree would be a great idea to move into that particular arena, which was really fairly new. Biomedical ethics had only blossomed in the late 70s and began to take force in the 80s. And I was right at the cusp, and being family medicine and dealing with death and dying all the time and cases, very difficult cases, I just felt a call to do that. So I left private practice and entered law school. And about that time, a Desert Shield storm came along, and I was a acting reservist for the U.S. Navy medical. And so I got called back and actually decided to just stay in and finish the career in aerospace medicine. And this is to say, long story shorter, hopefully, when I retired and came to Dallas, this renewed call for medical ethics, for more study of theology. So I finished a master's in theological studies and began to work with medical students at UT Southwestern. So I'm a clinical, a volunteer clinical professor in the Department of Psychiatry at UT Southwestern. And so I actually facilitate ethics discussions and ethics case studies with the medical students from the first year medical school to the last year medical school. And it's really been quite a challenge this past year with the COVID-19 and all that. But an important topic. I can talk substance of what the medical ethics are, but I think the general thrust is really, it's so important for medical students to understand the personal, the professional, the legal ramifications of the work that they're about to enter. Not to mention the compassionate component which in today's world, healthcare yes. world, is unfortunately lacking to a significant degree. And that's where we're going to be paying more attention as we move forward. So sorry for the long story, but.
Oh, are you kidding? You have barely whetted my appetite. You took 20 tangents there that I could spend the next hours on. And from what you said, talk about the role of compassion. How does that? Clay and I, you know, we're talking about the definition of this word, and how does that work in it being an active noun? I don't know, grammatically that's not, but it is not a passive state, but it is something that is active. And that's why we're in search of this. And this is why we want to keep bringing you on over and over again to help with the nuances here and what you're seeing and experiencing.
I love that question. In fact, I addressed it just probably within the last hour with one of the CIT second level facilitators. In CIT, the value of compassion is really taught as a pure noun. It is the motivation that leads to discernment, which then should lead to action. Now, I was brought up in the world thinking compassion as many do as not only a noun but also a verb. And so for me to transition as a CIT facilitator myself, and Clay knows, he's been through the program, it's taken an adjustment for me. But I think that this value of compassion, it is not the warm fuzzy bear that or warm fuzzy bunny that a lot of people think. It's certainly not pity. It is active, but I would call it more a neurophysiologic, neurochemical active noun, because the activity that occurs in the head when we start talking about compassion and the definition of compassion really becomes active neurologically. And I can talk more about that. I'm excited about the work of a number of researchers, specifically in the healthcare arena. Steve Tresiak, for example, he and another researcher up in New Jersey published a book called Compassionomics. Maybe you're familiar with that.
No, I'm not. Compassionomics.
Compassionomics.
I know new words every day.
It's what a great word.
It's pretty exciting. And when the book came out, I mean, I scoffed it up and read it within a couple of days, but it's pretty detailed. I mean, it's probably one of the most in-depth research of the literature that's available on compassion work and experiments, things to indicate, you know, what is this thing, compassion? How does it work in the healthcare arena? And so with this very extensive research, they came to three conclusions. And one was compassion matters in healthcare. Number two, it can be learned. But the kicker is you got to want it. And many, you know, with the attitude out there these days is, that's this warm, fuzzy thing. Everybody's compassionate. We don't need to be more involved in that, but that's that couldn't be further from the truth.
Yes,
you were mentioning CIT. That's the Compassion Integrity Training, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is Compassion Integrity Training. This is a training that you have. Did you create this and take it, Charlie?
No, actually, this was a program that was developed at a Life University in Atlanta, Georgia. It is probably one of, I would say, the three premier comprehensive compassion cultivation training, education training programs that's out there. You have a compassion cultivation training at a Stanford University that was developed probably a decade ago. Mm-hmm. You have cognitive-based compassion training developed out of Emory University, also in Atlanta. But then its cohort in the Atlanta area, Life University, developed this compassion integrity training, which has, I think, a few advantages. It's a course that's 10 weeks long. I mean, Clay, you could describe this as good as I can.
Could you please, Clay?
Oh, well, you're doing a great job, Charlie.
No, tell us about it, Clay.
Well, it takes us through. It takes us through like Charlie was saying, the basics and into self and then others and then into systems. And we did the 10 weeks over 4 weekends. Three weekends.
Three Saturdays.
Wow. Yeah. It was a fire hose, but really valuable and filled a gap in my understanding as we're looking, you know, in search of the new compassionate male. So
exactly. And that's where, and Charlie, I love this idea of how we get there, because when compassion ends up being something that is so important. And the more I dig into it, the more I see it's a muscle that I have to work and I have to build and I have to actually be in there and to get in that. And it's the difference between the icing, which is the sugar high, which is the fear, or, you know, being able to do something or do I want to build this? So are you... My sense is, and again, you please understand, I'm wired optimistic, so you can help me to know where this is. It appears to me that I am wired for this, that the groundwork is there. This is not something that has to go in and like an add-on and put on, but this is a basic part of my nature that needs to be built rather than something on the add-on that has to be put on. Your thoughts?
I think you're right on, Dennis. We are hardwired for that, but I think that we have to look at human nature, and it's positive as well as it's negative. We do have the potential for some awfully evil stuff, as we've witnessed as humanity through the ages. But we're also hardwired for the good stuff, and really when it comes down to the wire, it really is a matter of choice. Now, there is the epigenetics that we can talk about. There's the genetics, the epigenetics. There's the environmental influences that can lead one to either or. But I think that the compassion movement in the world is one that has chosen this is the way we as a global society need to be. We need to cultivate compassion for global social transformation. And part of what we're doing with ourselves as males, the new compassionate male, is to recognize that part of us, that hardwired part that has been so neglected over the centuries, over the millennia. You know, there's this stereotype that we're put in, and it's not fair. You know, it's not fair because I think we, as hopefully developing compassionate males, recognize this, as Clay and I have talked many times, this yes. feminine part of our being is this masculine part, and it's both in the female gender and the male gender. And
yes.
Once we recognize that and make those choices, then we can really move into realization of compassion.
Yeah, it's all the integration of the two. You know, I was when we were talking to Karambu in Kenya, she made the point that, yeah, we men have got to understand the divine feminine within us. Yes. And women need to integrate the divine masculine within them. And it's interesting that we're not hearing much talk about that, but it's all about the guys integrating the divine feminine.
Well, it's one of those things. I want to scroll back for a little bit and just help me understand the word epigenetics.
It's a term that's being used more. I just read several articles on the flourish model, which is really looking at a model of well-being. And we can go all the way back to Aristotle and talk about eudaimonia, which is, you know, which is a, his definition really was one more consistent with well-being, the well-being of a person, and not just, quote, the happiness that we sometimes associate with that word. And I think that what we understand is that there is a genetics that we're born with that has been with the mutations, with the environmental influences that actually we now know. I mean, science now knows that our genetics can be affected during our life and can be transmitted into our offspring, so that there is a genetic inheritance that we have. But then even in our individual development and our own lives, there's the environmental stuff that actually can affect. And that's what we define as that epigenetic phenomena. And I think the more we recognize that, the more it becomes critical that we understand, you know, when that baby's born, we need to start cultivating right then. So that means we've got to cultivate it with parents, so that when the baby's born, and interesting enough, there are programs developing out there that are focusing on parenting prior to the birth of an infant. We got a program here in Dallas, Fort Worth, called Lumen, that actually does that. It's a Montessori type of program after birth and once they get to pre-K and K through 12. But they identify parents that want to be a part of this school system when they're pregnant. And then they actually begin to engage with them. And so, you know, when you start talking about this epigenetics and genetics and environmental effects, that's where we have to start in the, yes, in the cradle. That's where the charter, I think, has made a major decision here within the past year to laser focus on compassion cultivation, education, and training.
That's wonderful. Are you seeing, Charlie, are you seeing the world, the race mind consciousness being more receptive to this over the past? I mean, because you're in the middle of it all the time, are you able to step back and say, wait a minute, I'm seeing nodes being connected. I'm seeing things that had not happened before, so we can have some bigger picture of it?
Absolutely. I mean, you take two of the biggest issues that our society, our U.S. society, is facing, and I think they exist in the rest of the world as well at one level or another. And that is the Black Lives Matter issue that has come to the forefront, as well as the police force and the resilience that we see doesn't really exist, or it doesn't exist at the level it needs to. Where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, when you get pulled over with a bad backlight, and all of a sudden it deteriorates into I can't breathe and death. That says a whole lot about, we got a long way to go to. But yeah, I think it's kind of like the fish story. You know, I mean, you know, the fish are swimming along in the water, and somebody comes along and says, "How's the water?" And they say, "What water?" So, you know, those of us in compassion work maybe could get into that sort of thing, where we're so so integrated into it until maybe we don't see things. But I think the kind of training that we go through really takes you to that point of uncomfortableness. I mean, Karen Armstrong is the first to say that a truly compassionate community or city is an uncomfortable city community. And what that means is that you see these issues.
Yes.
Then there comes this agency, this, you know, what agency do we have? What do we think we have? Our perception. And here's where CIT training again comes in, where you begin with self-compassion with four skills. You then move into compassion for others, four skills. And then you really spend some time with systems in the last two skills, skills 9 and 10. And again, this is just one model, one program with regard to learning what compassion is all about and how to embrace it, choose it, embrace it, and make it a part of who you are. You know, your DNA, as we say, in your DNA. It needs to be in our DNA.
I have been growing so much since I've been working with you, Clay, and you, Charlie, and the work that I have been doing on myself. And I love that as a model because I have to go inside out. That's the only way I can actually be effective in the world is to build those internal how I treat myself, I find myself how I treat the world. I can do it for a short time, taking care of someone else before I'm actually have the infrastructure inside of me to be able to do, but it doesn't sustain. It doesn't really feed other people. It doesn't really help. And to be able to, can you talk a little bit about the role of boundaries in compassion and being able to have very clear boundaries so that you can go out and do. I mean, there's only so many hours in the day and so many hours that you can that you can do in order for you to be able to say, okay, I'm going to leave this up to the universe. I'm going to say, okay, this is enough.
I don't know, Clay, you probably are thinking the same as me in terms of empathic distress. I think that's yes. Sort of what you're touching on.
Yeah.
Maybe Clay, maybe you want to say some things about that.
You know, I just take that as a burnout, and sometimes it's conscious and sometimes it's unconscious. You know, I'm pouring my heart and soul into getting this word out. Heart and soul to help this person there. And at a certain level, it's wearing on me and I'm becoming less and less effective and deteriorating in the process. So if I'm not, I become no good to anybody else, I become no good to myself. And it is a real concern. It's gotta be minded.
I think that's a reality that I think with the kind of training we're talking about, you do come to a realization that, you know, that there is just so much you can do. But rather than getting to that point where, well, it's just so overwhelming, so I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah. Exactly.
You train to say, well, I can't do everything and I can't solve the big picture issue, but there is some little something I can do, a simple act of kindness.
Yes.
A telephone call to an elderly person who's alone in this COVID-19 environment. I mean, mm-hmm. You say, well, you know, because most of us have egos that, well, I want to do something big, you know, and all that, but you know, I think part of this is learning equanimity. Right, Clay? I mean, equanimity to say, well, I know I just can't, but I think here's where I would be start talking about our spiritual being.
Right.
The Flourish model talks about, and of course, it's not anything new. I mean, we all know.
What is, Charlie? Charlie, what is? I've never seen any. I have never had any profound revelation in my entire life that I haven't known. God sat there and gone inside of me. Yeah. I knew that. It's
it's almost like duh.
Yeah.
So this Flourish model uses does Maslow's hierarchy of. You know, of needs and incorporate several different models. But the basis is who we are as living creatures, as human beings, with our physical needs, our emotional needs, our mental ability, our intelligence, and then that spiritual part. And I was just at a meeting with a group of men that get together once a month. We call ourselves the We've been meeting for 10 years now.
What do you call yourself?
Last night we the Philosophs with an F, F-I-L-O-S-O-F, P-H, Philosophs.
Nice.
Like Filio Brothers.
I love it.
So it's a good group, and we've really bonded over the years. But last night we talked about the topic of happiness and talked about all the various and sundry historical development of what happiness is and well-being. But this idea, this ecology of well-being, this flourish model, takes those four things and actually incorporates them in a way and brings in, it's almost like a, the guy that does the integral philosophy guy.
Wilbur?
You know, Ken Wilbur.
Ken Wilbur. Taking that synthesis, antithesis, type of approach. And so I see this model, which has only been recently put out, as a next integrative step in our level of consciousness, which seems to be hopefully increasing as we go along. But I wanted to get back to something you said earlier about what do I do internally? I get that empathic distress. And for me, and I said, that's where I want to start talking spirituality. There is this concept in the Bible, in the Christian Bible, the New Testament, in Philippians, I think it's chapter 2, verses 5 through 12. It's called the kenotic prayer. And it has to do with the emptying of oneself. And we last night, we sort of tied that in with the Buddhist concept of negation, of negating all this. You can see my background, all this stuff around me, and I think that we as human beings struggle with this need for security, this real deep down inside denial of death. I mean, we all know that we're not going to be living forever in this physical shape. And so we're constantly building stuff around us to secure. And I think it's the Buddhists are onto something when they talk about this process of negation. Thupten Jinpa, who is also one of the co-authors of the Compassion Cultivation Training from Stanford, talks about this and does a beautiful presentation on how one goes into this realm of negating all this stuff around us. Kierkegaard was another one, Christian theologian Kierkegaard, also did the same thing and said that until we can really negate all the stuff that's around us, we can't really transcend ourselves and move into that realm of equanimity and acceptance of who we are in the cosmos. And that we're always going to be a part of it, but just different, different along the way.
How could we not? I mean, if the laws of conservation of matter and energy, where could we go?
Yeah, you always think, well, we're all, each one of us are unique with our DNA and our and everything. And so we have, there'll never be another one of you, Dennis. There'll never be another one of Clay. In this world, but our work, our consciousness, our spirits will live on, as humanity gets more and more compassionate, hopefully.
It appears, I mean, couldn't we arguably say that, I mean, there's no guarantee on we're going to make it, we're going to survive what we're doing to the planet or what, I mean, there's nothing, but I think that we could arguably say that people are more connected now than they have ever been. We can arguably say that there is more peace qualitatively on the planet than there's ever been. Fewer wars, there are many where we to be able to step back and look at it and say, if they survive, these human beings maybe are on a track, on a direction that it's hard for us to see when we're in the middle of it.
Clay, you've been too quiet.
I
want to hear from you.
Well, first, I want to go back to the empathic concern. One thing I didn't mention was just walking into a room where there's trauma, you know, not even being in action, but just picking up that energy and I call it the vibrational energy of what's going on around, or just turning on the TV, you know, and seeing the what's going on out there, turning it on, and George Floyd. And to me, that's, you know, there's a trauma involved in that that I know sure affected me in May when I realized what had happened there. There was something else I was going to say, and I can't.
Don't you love it when you fall off the train? I have this vision, Charlie.
This was a dynamic.
you know how you're out in the middle of the desert, and here's one of those old passenger trains, you know, with a caboose, and here I fall off the train, and I just see that train of thought just disappearing, and I'm going.
Well, at least you can see the caboose.
Just that light.
That I can see the caboose. I'm wondering, where did it go? Well, yeah. One thing I did discover in listening to the wonderful podcast that you guys have been doing all along is this idea of, okay, so I'm not the youngest person in this group, and I may be the oldest in this group of three. I don't know.
Oh, cool. I'm 72, and Clay 66, okay, so.
Yeah, and I am 74. So
perfect. So we're all right. So. We're in that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, hey guys, yeah. I remember what it was I was going to say. So let me say it before I lose it again.
Perfect.
This whole notion, you know, Dennis, you were talking about. Well, there's, you know, more peace, although we don't necessarily see it. The more I get out there, and the more men that I engage with, the more men's groups and men's organizations that I see that the world doesn't see. And I really, really believe that there's an undercurrent of men that have the right intention. They may be looking at it from different vantage points, but they're aiming at the same general thing. But we don't see them, you know, because that's not newsworthy. We had a conversation with Brett Chernin.
Yep.
And
he's down in Australia. He's down in Australia, Charlie.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And he's got a Facebook group with 5,000 participants, 5,000 men. And he's got a huge, huge network, and they're from all over the world. And of course, we talked with Patty down in Tasmania.
Yeah.
The work that he's doing with men. It's all over the place. And it's really heartening from my vantage point to see that.
And that's where I think you come in, Charlie, so much, is because you have been, whether you accept it or not, but accept it from us. You have been laying the groundwork. You have been doing the heavy point work, the point of digging out there and getting some of that brush away so that this stuff could grow. Mm-hmm. And the heavy lifting that you have done, I want you to know how much both of us love and honor you for the work that you're doing, so that we can come along, and when we get a chance, these sprouts have a place to grow. Mm-hmm. And that because of the heavy lifting that you've been out there doing and the work that you've been doing, and both of us admire you so much for that opportunity for bringing us here.
Well, I'm humbled to hear that, Dennis. It's I think this is a movement that's not just a one person or several people, but I think Clay is right on target when he says this is a grassroots movement that I think is quite honestly spirit-led. And I think we just you know, the spirit's that train. We just need to catch it and hang on.
That's
to
it. All right, and you just reach your arm out and pull me aboard, and we'll go because that's me running beside the. All right, Charlie. Is there anything else in the last couple of minutes that we haven't talked about that we should talk about today?
Golly, there's so much. I would love to
come back.
Don't worry. Don't worry. There'll be the next part. You are one of our prime rotating. Yeah. Rotating conversation.
Standing invitation.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity to be with you two. It's really, really very special. And Clay, you know how I feel about the work that you're doing. And Dennis, you're bringing it to the fore for people to see through podcasts, this grassroots movement that's occurring all over the world. So more, you know, more to come. And I plan to be right with you as we go along together. So thanks so much for the invitation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie.
Well, that is our pleasure. And that's another episode of In Search of the New Compassionate Male with our wonderful guest, Charlie Barker, and our host, Clay Boykin. I'm Dennis Tardon, and we will see you next time.